Now, that's a rare book, needless to say, because somebody's bought up all the copies they could and burned them. But I've got one of them they're not going to burn, and it's an excellent book. You know, it's weird. It shows how wine is the only thing they found that can cause your pancreas to be stimulated to working again. And yet if you take very much wine when you have diabetes, it'll kill you. And yet if you just sip a little bit and a little bit and a little bit, you know, from day to day to day, it's the only thing that'll start your pancreas back up to work again. Well, liquor, the servant of man. Well, there is a lot about that we don't know. But can you imagine a germ not being able to live 3 minutes in honey? Well, God says, my son, eat you honey, because it is good. And the honeycomb is sweet to your taste. Now, he warns you a little later about not eating too much of it, because it's like wine. It can kill you, too. There have been examples of armies that were fatigued, and they decided what they needed to do was guzzle down a bunch of honey so they'd have quick energy in the heat of battle, and they died from overdoing it. I can read that out of the Lamb in the Book is the name of the book that has that in it. Well, notice the spiritual parallel with this physical comment. In the same way that you're to eat honey because it's good, the same way you should, the knowledge of wisdom is the same way to your soul. So the Jews, with each sentence they teach a little baby, put a piece of honey in their mouth along with it. And later on they use a little bit of wine to put on with it. So they teach them knowledge is sweet. Knowledge is yummy. It's tasty. It's good. And they do that from the time they're little. Well, in a way God is saying that here. So shall the knowledge of wisdom be like honey to you. It'll be good. So when you found knowledge, then it'll be sweet to your taste, like the honeycomb. There'll be a reward. Your expectation shall not be cut off. In other words, your end result will be everlasting life. What your goal is and your purpose for the future is sure. Unlike the wicked, their end is, they're cut off. They're dead. Lay not wait, O wicked man, against the dwelling of the righteous. Spoil not his resting place, because the just man might fall 7 times and rise up again, but the wicked will fall into mischief. Now, don't ever use verse 16 to justify sinning 7 times. You know, some have even translated that way. They've translated it, a just man fall 7 times in sin. Now, it doesn't say that. Notice that's the last part of a parallel. Verse 15 and 16 go together. What he's saying here is, if someone who's wicked lies in wait against the dwelling of the righteous and spoils his resting place, the just man might fall under the hand of the wicked 7 times, but he's going to rise up again. But not the wicked. Boy, when they fall, that's going to be the end. They're going to be cut off in their end of their fall. They're going to fall into mischief. So a just man might suffer calamity. He might have floods and lightning and accidents. A just man might fall 7 times, but he's going to rise up again. But once the fall of the wicked comes, that's the end of him. Now, take that verse in context. And now verse 17 and 18 are another duet. Don't rejoice when your enemy falls. Don't let your heart be glad when he stumbles. Because Christ said, you know, do good to those who despitefully use you and pray for those who persecute you. You know, you can heap coals of shame on their head. So don't let your heart be glad when he stumbles, lest the Eternal see it and it displease him and he turn away his wrath from him. Now, that doesn't mean God is deciding when to turn away wrath from somebody going the wrong way, depending on how everybody else reacts toward him, you know. But God warns us about not rejoicing when the enemy falls. Don't fret yourself because of evil men, verse 19. And boy, that's hard not to do, too. You get all worked up and upset and ulcerated and angry, but God said, you needn't do that. And he told you the world's that way, and he told you man's gone his own way and it's going to get worse, so don't fret yourself because of evil men. Neither be you envious at the wicked. So to do either one isn't good for you. To do either one isn't right. So don't fret yourself or don't be envious. Verse 20 ties in with 19. There will be no reward to the evil man. The candle of the wicked is going to be put out. So you don't want to envy your candle being put out. So he comes back to my son again, verse 21. My son, fear you the eternal and the king. So it's right that we should fear authorities, because we wouldn't be before them if we might not have been accused of doing something wrong, and maybe we didn't know it. And, you know, you're going to have to pay for it. So, you know, God's people do have a fear of those in authority, whether they're policemen or principals or mayors or whoever they are. So fear the eternal and the king, and don't keep company with those that are seditious, those that are given to change, those that dislike the establishment, those that want to overthrow the past and come up with something new. You know, it's kind of interesting what he's talking about here. Revolters or revolutionists, innovators, reckless agitators, disorganizers, disturbers of the peace, troublemakers against the church, independent Christians, bad-mouthers, railers, free thinkers. Don't keep company with them. Avoid them. Flee from them. Stay away from them. Now, 2,000 or 3,000 people didn't do that and ended up out of the church in the last few years because they listened to seditious and those that were given to change. They wanted something new. They wanted to water down. They just wanted something in their own name. Their calamity shall rise suddenly. Just zap, and all of a sudden they're gone. Who knows the ruin of them both? Those that rebel against the king and against God. Those are the both he's talking about here. Who knows the ruin of them both? Those who've dissimulated and railed and caused division and been independent against the king or against God. Verse 23, these things also belong to the wise. It's not good to have respect of persons in judgment. Now, respect of persons, literally in the Hebrew, means recognize faces. It's not good to recognize faces in judgment. You know, a judge would be better off if he's blindfolded, so he didn't know who's before him. Oh, A.B., oh, old friend there, you know. Yeah, let me see here. I can make this light for you. You know, and then they call you in before it, and they, oh, a Californian, huh? Boy, those Californians, and they sock it to you because you're from California. Well, that's the kind of judgment we've got in the world, you know. It's not good to have respect of persons in judgment. Right's right, and wrong's wrong, and judgment's justice, and what's it got to do with who it is? But that isn't the way it is in the world. It's who you know, and who you are, and who you work for, and he that says unto the wicked, you're righteous. We've had people do that in the last 10 years. Him shall the people curse. Nation shall abhor him. But to them that rebuke him shall be delight. And a good blessing shall come upon them. Now, we do that if we respect persons in judgment. That all ties in there together. Why would you say to someone who's wicked just because he's your friend or your neighbor or your kinfolk? Right is right and wrong is wrong. It doesn't make any difference who it is. But you can't say to the wicked, well, you're righteous. Oh, that's all right, Bill. You know, you didn't mean it. Or it's funny how you can wink at things about a friend and condemn it with somebody you don't like. So people are going to curse people that judge with respect to persons. Nations abhor anybody that's going to judge with respect to persons. You've got to rebuke those that are wicked. And then that'll be the delight. A good blessing will come on them. Now, verse 26. Every man shall kiss his lips that gives a right answer. Now, that's really ought to be taken in the same context of what has been spoken above about not judging with respect to persons. So any judge that gives a right answer when a judge speaks upright words or gives a just decisions, men would salute him with respect and affection. And of course, he mentions they had an Eastern custom of kissing the writing that contains the order of a ruler or a judge. The Septuagint translation says, "Lips shall kiss those things that answer to right words." Those writings are the decrees that correspond to the principles of equity and justice. So anytime anybody in those days got a written sentence that was fair and equitable and just, they'd kiss it. And that's what this is talking about. This is not talking about men kissing men or people kissing people. Every man would kiss the proclamation of lips that gives the right answer. Now, verse 27, a great wisdom here. "Prepare your work without, and make it fit for yourself in the field, and afterwards build your house." Now, we've always counseled people that way. We've told people, now look, don't just pick up your wife and kids and go moving off to Houston because there are a lot of jobs down there. You go down there and get a job and work a few weeks and get an apartment, and then you come and get your wife and kids to go down there. You know, every time I think of the pictures of Switzerland, that's what they do. When they go out on the property they bought, first thing they build is a combination house barn, and they live in this barn with the animals in the nicer part. And then as they're able to gain from their fields and their crops, they start building this home on top of that. And then they move upstairs and leave the animals down where they used to be. But that's real smart. It's living by God's word. Now, another thing he might be saying here is, get yourself established in your business before you take on a household, a wife and kids. Don't marry until you've got a stability there. Now, don't go to the other extreme. One guy down in Big Sandy one time told me that he'd set a goal for himself and he wasn't going to be married till he had $10,000 in the bank. Well, that's weird, you know. I wouldn't be married even yet if I waited that long. So, that's going overboard, you know. That's not what this doesn't say, own a bank and then build your house. Prepare your work without. Now, to get your crops planted first. You couldn't do that in North Dakota, you know. You'd have to live in a tent and you'd freeze to death and never get to enjoy them. So some climates you can prepare your work outside and live in the tent and then build your house as you've got your income established coming in. Verse 28, be not a witness against your neighbor without cause, and don't deceive with your lips. Don't say, I'll do so to him as he's done to me. I'll render to the man according to his work. In other words, don't have any vengeance toward a neighbor. And if your neighbor is being tried in a case, then don't be a witness against your neighbor without cause, out of carnality or ill feeling. Or you'll see a little later he says, go get settled between you and your neighbor. Why bring a third party into it? You know, don't let things build up against your neighbor. Now, verse 30 through 34 is all together. It's a picture of going by the field of the slothful, going by the vineyard of the man void of understanding. Lo, it's all grown over with thorns. Nettles covered the face thereof. The stone wall thereof was broken down. Then I saw, considered well, I looked upon this and received instruction. How did that field and that fence and all that get in that condition? How did that vineyard have all those thorns and nettles and, well, nobody hoed them out, nobody pulled them up, nobody was there working, somebody was just lazy. Somebody was a sloth. Sure enough, you had a little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to sleep. So shall your poverty come as one that travels. Now that word literally means a highwayman or someone that's never staying in one place, just, you know, carefree, irresponsible. Never settling down, never settling into it and getting something done. Your want is going to come as an armed man. Always gone to war. Always out fighting. Never able to work in your property, in your home, in your garden, your field. Well, that's what happens to the field of the slothful. Somebody that doesn't have any get up and go or any energy. So if you observe diligently the end result of a man that's a sloth, then you're going to find it. Now, verse 33 and 34 are exactly the same as chapter 6, verse 10 and 11, which we read earlier. Other verses that talk about the sloth and this condition existing are chapter 18, verse 9, and chapter 19, verse 15. I have those in after verse 31 to chain reference the two together. Okay, you come to a third division, Proverbs of Solomon, the men of Hezekiah, king of Judah, copied out. So apparently after God had already given these 24 chapters of Proverbs, they needed a supplement to it. So later on in the days of Hezekiah, they discovered all these Proverbs of Solomon, and God inspired Hezekiah to copy out another segment of them. So you have this suffix added on to what you had before. It's the glory of God to conceal a thing, but the honor of kings is to search out a matter. So how many things of God are something you have to dig and dig and dig before you ever learn? God has concealed all kinds of information and truths and knowledge and reality. But it's the glory of God to conceal a thing. The more you read His book, the more you see you didn't see before. The more you get to know God, the more you see into everything that has been concealed before. So you discover the glory of God by digging into all these things God has concealed. But kings, the opposite is true. It's the honor of kings to search out everything, to find all the facts, get all the details, not judge with half judgment. The only way kings will ever get honor is if they're faithful that way, to get everything, all the facts, all the information, all the details, without judging otherwise. Now, the heaven for height and the earth for depth, and the heart of kings is unsearchable. They don't ever have to tell you why they made a decree. They don't have to explain and get your okay and let you understand it and why we think God should. We know kings don't have to. You know, how much do you understand about politics? Boy, oh boy, you're not expected to understand. That's why you've got governmental people up there that are elected. They do all that. You're never going to figure it all out. They probably don't even understand it either. But, you know, God says, when you think of the height for heaven, or the heaven for height, and you think about the depths of the earth, the oceans, that's the way kings' hearts are. They're so high and so deep, beyond anything we could ever search out. They should be superior people to get to be kings. And then they don't have to explain or reason or justify. Now, verse 4 and 5 are tie in together. Take away the dross from the silver, and then you can get a fine vessel of silver. Take away the wicked from before the king, and that's just like taking the dross away from silver. His throne will be established in righteousness. His throne will be like purified silver in a beautiful tray or a beautiful silver piece. So kings ought to have the wicked taken from before them, just like dross out of silver. Verse 6 and 7 go together. Don't put forth yourself in the presence of the king. In other words, set not out your glory. Don't be bragging about who you are or boasting about being somebody great. Don't try to impress a king with who you are. What impresses a king is humility, not who you are. Don't put forth yourself in the presence of the king. And don't put yourself forward presumptuously in the place of great men. It's better that it be said that you come up here than that you should be put lower. You know, Christ repeated this proverb in a different way about don't seek the upper seat, you know, sit back, and then if they'll see that you're really somebody, and they'll say, hey, come on up here, we've got a seat for you up here. And so don't choose out the chief seats. Better that you should be come up here than that you should be put lower in the presence of the prince whom your eyes have seen. Don't go forth hastily to strive. In other words, don't be one that begins controversy, lest you know not what to do in the end thereof, when your neighbor has put you to shame. So if you get all emotionally worked up and charge right into a controversy, you might find out later it was emotion and you don't have a leg to stand on when he starts getting down to brass tacks. You've seen that happen before. So be cautious about beginning a controversy or vigorously launching into some controversy. Verse 9, debate your cause with your neighbor himself. Don't get a lawyer involved with you. Don't get a third party. Don't get others. You're your neighbor's brother, so you get things settled between the two obvious neighbors. Don't have to go in as a witness against your neighbor without cause, which we were warned in the last chapter. Be a neighbor to your neighbor personally. Discover not a secret to another. In other words, don't tell a third party about a secret problem between you and your neighbor. You and your neighbor get it solved. Now, boy, that verse smites you in the face many a time. Because how many times do you talk about a problem you have with a neighbor to a third party? What on earth for? What good's that? It's got to be solved with the neighbor that you got the problem with. So what good does it do to bring a third party in? So the one that's going to hear you is going to put you to shame. He's going to say, well, why didn't you get with your neighbor and settle that? So you take it to a third party or you get a lawyer involved and you're going to be put to shame. They're going to say, well, look, why didn't you just get together and get this settled between the two of you? Your infamy won't turn away. Again, on the tongue, verse 11, a word fitly spoken is like apples of gold in pictures of silver. So if you can paint a picture of a silver tray with gold and red apples and bananas and grapes and things on it, that's the way a word fitly spoken is. A pat on the back. A frank warning to a brother headed to death. A brotherly kindness given to somebody. A word fitly spoken, you know, in the power of the tongue is life and death. As an earring of gold and an ornament of fine gold, and you notice when God is likening spiritual things to physical things, he never in a good light ever refers to lipstick or makeup or eye paint or something. Nothing wrong with a gold earring. Nothing wrong with a gold necklace or a gold bracelet. Any more than there's anything wrong with a wise reprover to an obedient ear. So anybody that'll hearken to you that you can reprove when they're in danger or they're going to end up in trouble, then that's as valuable as a gold earring or a necklace or a bracelet of fine gold. But it takes guts to reprove somebody. Carnally, you always think you're going to get more favor with a brother if you flatter him and pat him on the back and never honest with him, never level with him, then you are to just come right out and lay it on the line. Now that's where your human nature deceives you, because you always think he's not going to like you if you do that. And yet God everywhere says, yes, he will. Yes, he will. He'll like you more. You'll be closer. You'll be more brothers. And your carnal mind says, no, he won't. He's going to dislike you. He's going to offend him. He's going to hurt his feelings. And well, you go by the Bible or you go by your own feelings. As the cold of snow in the time of harvest, so is the faithful messenger then that send him, because he refreshes the soul of his masters. So anybody that's dependable and loyal and faithful to you, sending them out with a message, that's like nourishing rains or good moisture of snow for a harvest. Whoever boasts himself of a false gift, in other words, you're always telling somebody you're going to do something. Well, I'm going to come out and see you, and we're going to go fishing, or I'm going to send you this book, and you don't ever do it. Next time you see a bunch of clouds and hope for rain and don't get any rain, then that's you. You know, that's the way we are. When we're always boasting of a gift we're going to give, and we don't ever give it. By long forbearing is a prince persuaded. In other words, you better be careful when you go before a prince that you delay any anger or resentment. You better have time, take patience. By long forbearing is a prince persuaded. So you blow off your top at a policeman that's arrested you and you're going to get yourself in worse mess. but by long forbearing you can persuade a prince, and by a soft tongue you can break a stiffness, you can break a callous hardness, break a rigidity like stiffened bones. Now, verse 16, have you found honey? Eat so much as is sufficient for you, lest you be filled therewith and vomited. So it's such a dangerous thing to overeat that God has made your system to where you'll vomit it if you overeat honey. So in the same way, your foot in your neighbor's house might be as sweet as honey. Verse 17, these two go together. So no matter how brotherly or how familiarity breeds contempt, that's another way of saying this, but you may have someone that you're just the greatest, closest brothers with, but God warns you, don't overspend time there. Let your foot be seldom in your neighbor's house. Withdraw your foot from your neighbor's house, lest he be weary of you. You know, I wondered when we were going to have the refresher about having people stay with you 3 weeks. I thought, boy, oh boy, I'm not so sure they can do that. And we're going to have John Coco from Chicago stay 3 weeks with us, and the Schurgers, and we had somebody with us over half the time. And I thought, that won't work. Boy, somebody living there day and night for 3 weeks, it won't work. But, you know, they were gone so much, it worked fine. We didn't even see them. You know, they'd come over here to class by 8 in the morning, and they didn't get back till late at night, so all they did was sleep there, and it worked out all right. But, you know, God warns you here about leaving your foot too long in your neighbor's house, no matter how good friends you are. It's like honey that's so good, sweet, healthy, a miracle thing God created. The bees digested it for you. It's the quickest thing to go into your blood there is, you know, except for wine. But God says, even though honey is that good, you know what happens to you if you overeat it. So if you keep your foot in your brother's house too much, he may vomit you out. You know, that's kind of what he's warning you there. Okay, verse 18. A man that bears false witness against his neighbor is a war club, a sword, a sharp arrow. So God really warns about that. Now, that doesn't mean call up in front of a court and raise your right hand. That isn't it. You say things about a brother you can't even more prove. You say things about a brother that absolutely aren't true. They're just dirty digs or sarcasms or insinuations, dropping filthy hints. You might as well be using a war club, a stabbing sword, a sharp piercing arrow. So be careful what you say about a neighbor or brother. Confidence in an unfaithful man in time of trouble is like a broken tooth. Right when you need it the most, it isn't there. It doesn't work. Like a foot out of joint. Boy, it's right when you need it. It isn't there. It fails you right when you need it. So other times it might help some, but boy, when you need it the most, it fails. Well, that's the way confidence in an unfaithful man is. Okay, has he that takes away a garment in cold weather and is vinegar upon nitre, so is he that sings songs to an heavy heart. You know, there are times when people get so down that you're not going to do them any good singing songs. Now, there are times when you're just lightly down and singing songs and do you a lot of good. But there are other times that you might as well see a guy in cold weather and say, let me have one of those garments and you'll be better off. And he gets colder and colder. He's already freezing, and you take off one of his garments. Well, that ain't going to do him any good. So if a guy's morose, and you sing songs, then when he leaves, he's even lower than he was when he came. So you took a garment off, and he already didn't have enough on for the cold. Now, that's the same way with vinegar on nitre. It's like throwing a ball of sodium on water. Wow! And blow up, you know. It doesn't work. It's not good. It's bad. So that's the way taking away a garment in cold weather or putting vinegar on nitre, that's the way you would if you sing songs to a heavy heart. Nitre's basically baking powder, baking soda. Now, verse 21 and 22 go together. If your enemy be hungry, give him bread to eat. If he be thirsty, give him water to drink. Well, boy, that doesn't sound like the Old Testament. You know, Jesus said, you've heard it's been said of old time, you hate your enemy and love God and hate your enemy, or love your neighbor, your friend, and hate your enemy. Well, depends on whether you had God's Spirit in the Old Testament or whether you were led by God's Spirit. If your enemy was hungry, give him bread to eat. If he be thirsty, give him water to drink. You'll heap coals of fire on his head. Now, you remember Paul quotes that in Romans. And the Lord shall reward you. So, in some cases, by being good to the enemy, you know, you could work a psychological thing on him and he'd be repentant, sorry he was attacking you. Verse 23, the northwest wind, as it should be here, not north wind, coming off the Mediterranean like it does here in California, the northwest wind brings rain, drives in rain, not drives it away. Maybe it drives it away all the way across you. That's the way an angry countenance does a backbiting tongue. Beats on you, and it's better to dwell in the corner of the housetop than with a brawling woman and in a wide house. Now, he's really picking different descriptive adjectives here, you know. That's another word, brawling woman. Somebody that's ready to fight. You know, she's an Amazon. She'll punch you in the nose and take you on, and she thinks obeying her husband's a matter of whether he's big enough to make her, you know. Well, that isn't the case. God's big enough to make you, you know. God's the one that gave those orders. God's the one that commands you to obey your husband, and it's better to dwell in the corner of the housetop than with a brawling woman. All right? Good news from a far country. That's like cold waters to a thirsty soul. A righteous man falling down before the wicked, being embarrassed before the wicked, or being misjudged before the wicked, that's as a troubled fountain. That's like going out to a fountain and finding out it's been trampled up by the foot of beasts, or arriving at a well or a spring and finding out it's been defiled or poisoned. Well, that's what you expect if you see righteous men being humbled or belittled or put down before the wicked. It's not what you expect. It never should be, any more than a life-giving fountain or spring being corrupted and poisoned. Now, a warning again, it is not good to eat much honey. So for men to search their own glory isn't glory. In other words, it isn't any more right for a man to seek after glory and tell everybody about his goodness and how great he is than it is to eat much honey. Now, honey's good, very tasty, but a little of it goes a long way. So nobody can stand to see somebody boasting and glorying themselves and praising themselves and always seeking after their own glory. He that doesn't have any rule over his own spirit is like a broken down city that doesn't have any walls. Where's your defense? Where's your security? Where's your protection? You hot-headed? You moody? You can't rule your tongue? If you don't have rule over your own spirit, you might as well be like a city that doesn't even have a wall around it and that's broken down.